Our speaker is Peter Brown, who's a professor from the School of Environment and the Department of Geography at McGill University. And he's written a book called Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. In fact, you've got it on the screen. And he's going to present a moral argument, I think that's fair to say. Is that right, Peter?
That's right.
And in contrast, Kate Soper, who is, I'll find the biography to make sure I get this right, Tim. Is at London Metropolitan University and teaches philosophy and critical theory and has come up with an idea of alternative hedonism, that a moral, a language of morality can actually be replaced by an alternative hedonism. We don't need this kind of moral language. So I'm going to ask Peter to speak and then Kate, and then hopefully we can open up that conversation to involve everybody about these two contrasting approaches to shifting value systems.
So I hope you can hear me okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for the introduction. And thank you to Resolve and and Tim Jackson and Michael Peters for the invitation to be here. It's wonderful. I've been thinking about these problems for about 25 years, and I have quite a bit to say. And I was talking to Tim yesterday about maybe saying 5% of it, right? And he got this look of a deer in the headlights, you know, about him, you know, about like if he says anything like that, you know, it's not going to work. So I apologize in advance for going over some pretty big issues pretty quickly. But it was a sort of right image for the university, which, of course, has the stag as its symbol. So I'm going to offer basically a kind of moral conceptual argument for thinking differently about economics and about our relationship to the earth. And my work is very influenced by, and this book grows out of a Quaker effort, by the way, where five of us ultimately contributed to this volume. I was the senior author, but it's very much a group effort. And we were very much influenced by Aldo Leopold's work, an American conservationist who wrote a very famous book, Sand County Almanac, published in 1949, and we took the notion of right relationship from a section of that book called The Land Ethic, and we modified it somewhat, but the basic idea we have about right relationship is what's shown on the screen here. A thing is right if it tends to preserve the integrity, resilience, and beauty of the commonwealth of life, wrong when it tends otherwise. So, let's see. So one way to figure out what right relationship is to figure out what wrong relationship is. And this is the tar sands project in Alberta, Canada. This is exactly the wrong way to do it. This is an extremely damaging way to get oil looked at ecologically. It's extremely efficient from a thermodynamic point of view. Natural gas is used basically to heat water to extract very heavy, very dirty oil from sand. There are very substantial carbon dioxide emissions connected with simply the extraction of the oil from the sand, let alone the burning of it. So this is pretty much backwards. Right relationship is something that we think is a common sense notion. You can have a right relationship with your wife, with your employer, with your city, right, and with your planet. And we think that right relationship should be the way we think about our relationship to the planet and about how there can be mutual prospering. So in a good marriage, for instance, both parties flourish and grow and become better, more thoughtful and sensitive persons. And you can have a relationship with the planet where we benefit the planet and it benefits us in a manner of reciprocal respect. So I think that our society is basically in fundamentally wrong relationship with the planet and with the life processes on it. And so I want to just take, maybe just make four major points about how to get into right relationship with the planet and its life processes. So I want to talk first about how we got on the wrong path. Second, how to re-envision who we are. Third, what the implications of this would be for the economy, and then lastly, what we can do as individuals and citizens to get on the right track. How we got on the wrong track, I think, goes back really to the origins of Western culture. And I'm very influenced on this subject by Albert Schweitzer's Philosophy of Civilization, where he says, in effect, that the Western tradition got off on the wrong track because it asked the question, what's good for humanity, as opposed to what's good for life, right? And so we started with too narrow a question, and it's been sort of channeling our thoughts and activities since then. The moral traditions that inform Western culture, both from the Judeo-Christian sources and the Greek sources, are pre-scientific. Right? There's been no significant adjustment in those traditions in an explicit way since the scientific revolution of the last several hundred years. And our situation is very much like a wonderful scene in the movie Magic Christian by Peter Sellers, where he's the richest man in the world and there's a conducting a board meeting on a train, and everything with his company is going wrong. If sales are down, public confidence is down, and so forth. He says, gentlemen, you're all fired, and you have to get off the train. So the train stops sort of nowhere, and they all get off, and as they get off, he hands each of them a map, right? but it's not a map of where they are, right? It's a map of Australia, a map of San Francisco, you know, a map of of coastal Maine. And that's sort of where we are as a culture, in my opinion, right? We have moral maps, or maps of morality, right? But they're not maps of where we are, right? So we are, in a very fundamental way, lost. Second is the Western tradition gets off with too narrow a conception of morality, right? The Good Samaritan story, known to virtually everybody in the room, I'm sure, is a story about the obligations between humans only. And if you recall, it comes in a parable from Jesus where he answers the question, what do I have to do, Master, to gain eternal life? And Jesus gives the two commandments. And I'll come back to that at the end of my talk, how to secure eternal life. And I have a picture of it, too. So if you've never seen it before, you know, hang on. It's going to be, if my timekeeper is right, 15 minutes from now, you will see a picture of eternal life. Okay, other ways that we got even further off track were in the rise of modern science with the goal of power over nature as opposed to understanding of nature, and then the Enlightenment conception of the human as the only rational being was a further problem, and then the sort of last blow that brought us to the present sort of inchoate state was the collapse of our value structures and the collapse of meaning, what the French sociologist Dufour has called desymbolization. So what I'm proposing to do is to change the question. How would we live if we change the question from how can we best dominate and use nature to how can we live with an ethics of respect and reciprocity toward the rest of nature and the earth? And I think if we change the question, we might be able to open our hearts and minds to a moment of grace, and that would help us rethink citizenship, rethink the economy, and our personal role in the future of a flourishing earth. So rediscovering who we are, I think we have to rethink the sort of master narrative of which we're a part. To see ourselves as part of a vast creative process on a small planet with a special set of responsibilities and opportunities, have to reimagine citizenship. One of the many big mistakes of the 20th century, it would take a long time to list them all, was the substitution of the notion of the person as consumer for the notion of the person as citizen. And I think we need to rehabilitate this notion. And then lastly, we have to come to a kind of communion with things. So one of the things that, in my view, is key to do is to change our conception of where we came from. This is obviously the Sistine Chapel, and there are two different ideas that are embedded in this painting. One is that humans are made in the image of God, and that God gave the world to man, or to humans, but it does say in the Old Testament man, for his use, for our use. And these ideas seem to me to be in need of a very thorough re-examination and to be replaced by ideas that are more like this. My picture isn't nearly as beautiful as Michelangelo's, but my picture is truer, right? We are a process, we're products of a process of co-evolution with the rest of life, and we are not the privileged beings we think we are. And I liked Lord Giddens' speech this morning in many ways, but it seemed to me that in many ways it epitomized, right, the worldview that has led us to the current crisis, right? Because it saw nature as separate from us, right? We don't really have to care about the fish. He actually said that explicitly. And the notion is that sort of we're here and it's out there is one of the major things that has brought about this disaster, although it took several thousand years to get here. So part of a different narrative is to see us, I'm sorry about the slide not working quite right, to see ourselves as part of a continuous process of creation. This is a photograph from the Hubble Space Telescope called the Pillars of Creation, and these are basically star factories, right? These are, these clouds are bombarded by ultraviolet rays and they give birth to things like the sun. This is a process that goes on sort of for extremely long periods of time. The universe has been evolving for about 14 billion years. And biological evolution is just a special case of a process of evolution that's of at least that length. And we need to see ourselves as part of that evolutionary process. And also as part of, also about that slide, there must be something in the way we put these on this computer. this is Earth from 4 billion miles away, taken by the Voyager in 1987. And this is what Carl Sagan had to say about that photograph. Earth is a small stage in a vast cosmic arena. And I'm not going to bother to read the whole thing. But to see ourselves as small, on a small space relative to a vast universe, but with special obligations and special possibilities by being members of this planet and its evolutionary life forms. And again, Leopold, I think, had a pretty good grasp of how we should think about our obligations, where he says it's our special nobility to be a society decently respectful of all life, capable of inhabiting the earth without defiling it. And I think if we're going to take up Leopold's challenge that's there, and also in the opening quote, we need to rethink what citizenship is. And I rely here on a very, very good book, a very short book by James Carse called Finite and Infinite Games. And he distinguishes between finite games like games of football or hockey or things like that, where there's a set number of players, where there's a set place, basically where the game occurs, where there's a referee, and where there are winners and losers. And he says, okay, there's nothing to matter with that, but there's also infinite games, where the point of the game is not to win, but to keep the game going, where the weaker player is aided by the stronger player, where the referee can join the game, right, where the game can be rescheduled, or the space can be expanded or contracted and so forth. The point of these games is to keep the game going. The point of the game we play that we call civilization is to keep the game of civilization going. Right? It's not to win. Right? It's to persist, basically, to endure and to flourish. And I think we need to think of citizenship in that context, right? That we're ultimately custodians, right, of our culture, of our earth, right, and of the future of life on earth at this point. And the ultimate infinite game, the game that sort of underlies all other games, is the game of evolution, right? It's the game that makes everything possible that we value. And what we're doing on earth now is we're closing down, basically, the evolutionary processes and pathways of the earth through biological and, to some degree, cultural extinction. So, we also need to rethink the idea of communion. And I've quoted here a short passage from Thomas Berry's The Great Work, We need to understand the universe is composed of subjects to be communed with, not as objects to be exploited. Use as our primary relationship with the planet must be abandoned. So it's an entirely different perspective. So now I want to talk just briefly about what this would all mean for macroeconomics. This is a subject of the book that Madeline held up, and which I have some copies with me, by the way, which I'd be pleased to sell. In fact, I'm eager to sell, both because I want everybody to read them, but also because I don't want to carry them back to Montreal because of breaking my right arm. Rethinking the economy, what we try to do in this book is to ask five very simple questions about the current economic order. What's it for? How does it work? How big is too big? What's fair? And how should it be governed? And so what I'm going to do is, just because hopefully everybody will have read Tim's report, it's also a very good book along somewhat similar lines by Peter Victor, Managing Without Growth, or the book that I wrote with my Quaker colleagues, I'll try to demonstrate why the current economic system can't give good answers to these simple questions. So I'm really going to just talk about very briefly what our answers to these questions are, as opposed to what the opposing side's answers are. So what's the point? What's the economy for? We basically say, well, in a way, ironically, Keynes had it right. One of the principal functions of the economy is social stability. Right? That's one of the things we try to get as a function of economic planning. But what Keynes left out, for very complicated historical reasons, which I'm going to touch on very briefly, is the world. Right? He didn't imagine that the human economy could expand to this to such a size that it would destabilize the Earth's systems. And so really what we need to do is just adjust the Keynesian goal, if you like, to include ecological stability, or better, ecological resilience, as one of the principal goals of economic activity. So this is basically just an image of a flourishing Earth, right? What the economy should aim at is, you know, a fecund, ebullient, flourishing, beautiful Earth, not what we're doing to it now. Okay, how does it work? That's the second question. Well, I'm very apologetic about the pedestrian nature of this recommendation, right? But you have to see that the economy is part of the universe and subject to its laws. Now, that seems like what could be more self-evident than that? But Chairman Bernanke, who's the U.S. Fed chief, wrote a textbook with some other economists, two other economists. If you look up the standard things on environment, biodiversity loss, climate change, etc., there's either no entry or you refer to page 30. On page 30, it says the economic indicators don't do a very good job of describing the relationship between the economy and the Earth or the biosphere. And then the other 585 pages of this book use those indicators, right? Okay. So, I mean, it's a clean mess. There's been no systematic connection between economics and the physical and biological sciences of the last 200 years. So these guys, you think the society in general is lost, these guys are really lost. So looked at this way, from the perspective of seeing the economy as embedded in the Earth and in the universe, the basic unit of wealth, the basic thing that makes all the things we value possible, is sunlight and photosynthesis, right? It's the capacity of green plants to turn sunlight into something that we can use, we and other life forms use. And this leads to a rethinking of some of the terms, fundamental terms of economics. I'm only going to touch on one of these because I know we started late and we're trying to keep to a little bit tighter schedule. But looked at this way, money is the socially sanctioned right to use part of the Earth's life support capacity. And the way we've distributed money in the Anglophile economies, is extremely unequally. And so some people on Earth have vast rights, as it were, to change the Earth's life support prospects. Other people have very, very small powers. And one of the things that we need to think hard about is that radical, but both the radical nature of money itself and its radical inequality. How big is too big? It's too big when it overwhelms the Earth's life support capacity, both its ability to build up complexity, complex things like you and I, complex things like this city, complex things like redwood trees in Wales, and also when it overwhelms the ability of the Earth's living systems to assimilate the waste stream, and that's sort of the climate change problem in one sentence. What's fair? Fourth question. Well, we basically say the fairness question breaks down into three parts. Fairness between humans who are existing together now. Fairness between humans and other species. Other species have justice claims, in my view. And then fairness between human species, present humans and future humans, and present humans and future species. And right now, human beings are using up about 40 to 50% of the Earth's ability or the Earth's photosynthetic capacity for ourselves. So we're one species out of, let's say, 20 million. We're taking half the cake. Okay. last question, how should it be governed? Here we've really gone off the rails, right? Because we lost in the interval between, in the late 50s maybe, and the present time, we lost the notion that the government really has a long-term fiduciary responsibility. And my view is that you can get a lot of the machinery needed to secure the future, as in Tim's report, by going back to Locke's theory of government in the Second Treatise of Civil Government, written around 1685. But we also have to realize that we've entered a post-national period. Right, that many of the problems that we have are not going to be solved by the current set of nation states, and I want to talk briefly about that now. Now, one thing we could do, of course, is to leave the government of the economy to the people who are now running it and basically running the planet. Therefore, this is Ben Bernanke on the right, Mark Carney, the head of the Bank of Canada. This will be a familiar face to many of you. Should we leave the government of this planet to these gentlemen? I say emphatically no. So let's try to rethink governance just a little bit, and then we'll be close to done. And I'm just going to mention a couple of things about the inadequacy of national governments. The first is velocity and capture. Excuse me, velocity and scale. When the present governmental systems were set up, the speed and size of environmental change was negligible compared to what it is now. And these systems have proven themselves pretty much incapable of dealing with the macro environmental problems that we have now. Second thing I'll mention just quickly is capture. Many governments are captured by their financial elite, certainly true in the United States. And so the ability of the government to sort of do its long-term fiduciary duties is seriously impaired. Why international governance isn't working, just a couple of examples. There's no means to ensure fairness, right? We have no standards of fairness across nations, across species, or across generations in the international governance system. And going again to the third point, there are enormous power imbalances in the international system, with the winners of World War II, particularly the United States, having far too much power. So what we suggest in our book is four institutions are not necessarily new. They're just somewhat different. One is some form of global democratic federalism, perhaps the European model, European Union model, with some very strong surgery to extract the neoliberalism from it. This is an idea from Myron Frankman, a colleague of mine at McGill. Second, establishment of trust to protect and restore the global commons like the atmosphere and the ocean. Third, an Earth or global reserve bank, somewhat similar to the Federal Reserve or Bank of Canada or Bank of England, where those banks use interest rates and the money supply to control the economy. The Earth or global reserve bank would try to understand how the planet actually works, right, and then use that as a way of coming up with a set of constraints on and directions for economic activity. And we suggest that one of the tools of that agency or entity would be the IPAT formula from Ehrlich and Holdren. IPAT is impact equals population times affluence times technology. And we added ethics to that because we think conduct should be a specific element in that. And the IPAD formula, I'll come back to this in the questions if anybody wants to ask it, is a very powerful tool to force you to prioritize what you're going to do. So when England gets a, or UK gets a carbon constraint, it can either reduce its population, reduce its wealth, change its technology, or change its conduct, but we can't have it always every way anymore. Those days are well past us. And lastly, making a mandatory world court. These are just images of these things. This is an image of an Earth Reserve from Bob Costanza. And I'm not, because I know I'm over time, I'm not going to stick with those. And then just last thing I want to point out is what can we do as individuals, right, to move toward an economics that's respectful of the Earth and the life on it? And these are ideas taken from both from the Quaker tradition and from other traditions of civil disobedience, particularly people have drawn on many of the same sources, Thoreau, obviously, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, and others. And what seems to be common to this way of approaching things is some sort of a clarification, right? Some sort of ability to identify your own strengths and what it is that's most important, what you're willing to give up for the struggle on which you are about to embark. It's a finding and a nurturing of a kind of inner strength and resolve, a kind of disposition to endure what's ahead. Second, it's a design for what we're going to do, what we want to have happen, what changes we think are essential. And these are the kinds of things we try to suggest in governance. Third, you seek some way of bringing about a mass conversion or a mass re-envisioning of the future. That's what this conference is about. This is what Resolve is about. It's what many of us who have the set of concerns I've talked about are trying to accomplish. And then if you can't get there simply by persuasion, right, you have to use nonviolent methods such as civil disobedience, direct action, or other things like that to make persisting on the present course painful. There's a reasonably pleasant story to tell, which I will, about the role of Quakers in banishing the slave trade from England. They circulated, this happened between about 1785 and 1815 approximately. They drew this picture of a slave ship transporting people from Africa to North America and circulated it among the British public. And people basically said, well, this isn't compatible with Christian values, it's not compatible with who we are as English men and women, and in, I think it was 1813, Parliament outlawed slavery. It was enforced by the British Navy, and was, you know, slavery still exists in the world, I know, right? It's a big step forward for human dignity. One more slide after this. So what are we, this is a sort of analog to that. We're in the process of leaving a planet that is going to have large numbers of environmental refugees. I don't think that's what any of us want. And we have to rethink who we are, what our economy is, and how to get there to get out of it. And there's my promised slide of eternal life. So that is a black spruce stump with a black spruce seedling growing out of the top. And if you say, well, that isn't quite the eternal life I was looking for, I'm sorry to tell you that's all that seems to be on offer. So make peace with it if you can. Thanks very much.